Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 92, section 4, which is old single column, page 1007. Okay, as we've been emphasizing in the first part of this paper, they were very much trying to give us a thumbnail sketch of everything that we discussed in detail in the preceding papers about the sort of the basic elements of evolutionary religion. You know, whether it was fetishism or shamanism or what have you, you know, all those various things that we've gone over a lot, all the basics of the ghost cult, etc. We've swept through all those again, and to give them a more holistic look from more definitively from the top down, where we're thinking more precisely about how all of those details are unfolding as the natural consequences of the functioning of agitant mind, in particular the sixth and seventh agitants, the agitants of worship and wisdom, with the full actualization of this more holistic top-down context potential with our encirclement in the Holy Spirit, you know, and the personality identifying with each of us as a Holy Spirit encircled creature. So we've completed that. That direct exercise. Now they want to bring in a kind of a similar thumbnail fashion, that that element that is slightly modified, what otherwise, as I just said, was a purely natural unfolding of all the details of evolutionary religion, that slight modification that we got, it's not normally, it's just a slight modification, but the slight modification that we got to that by epical revelation. You could say that the most consequential of the five so far, the five epical revelations so far, is the fourth. Jesus of Nazareth made a pretty significant impact on the culture of the planet. It all kind of melted into the evolutionary religious context, like we've talked about quite a bit already. But nonetheless, it's noticeably different because of his efforts, kind of in spite of ourselves. He managed to leave behind a significant impact that continues to helpfully challenge evolutionary religionists to not be quite as natural as they would be otherwise. Do unnatural things like love your enemies, for instance. Those sorts of little unnatural encouragements that he managed to get injected into the system. We haven't really looked at that, so we need to do that. And we'll see in this opening paragraph that they're going to emphasize what you hear me mention all the time when we talk about epical revelation, that it's designed to synchronize as precisely as possible with the evolutionary process. And You know, if you ever wondered, it's like, well, where in the book could I find a place that sort of speaks more directly to what you're saying all the time like that, Chris? Well, you know, here's an example right here, this paragraph. So, you know, let's take a look at that. And, you know, and then, you know, as we get into this section, everyone who's read the book remembers that this section is in here. You might occasionally forget where it is, but here's where it is. This is where they give you little thumbnail sketches of each of the five epical revelations. So we'll get to do that fun little sweep through history like that. So let's see what they have to say up front first.
4, the gift of revelation. Revelation is evolutionary, but always progressive. Down through the ages of a world's history, the revelations of religion are ever expanding and successively more enlightening. It is the mission of revelation to sort and censor the successive religions of evolution. But if revelation is to exalt and upstep the religions of evolution, then must such divine visitations portray teachings which are not too far removed from the thought and reactions of the age in which they are presented. Thus must and does revelation always keep in touch with evolution. Always must the religion of revelation be limited by man's capacity of receptivity.
Let me see there at the end. Always must. Okay, so this is very definitive what they're speaking to here. So it starts out where it says revelation is evolutionary. Okay, now that point you don't hear me make as frequently. And if you don't quite understand, it's like, well, what do you mean evolutionary? Well, you know, they know you're thinking that, so they give you that next sentence about how it's ever expanding and successively more enlightening. So when you know, not a particular revelation, but the whole series, it's actually a logical series. It's a sequence, that whole sequence of revelations, epical revelations. In general, has an overarching synchronization with the evolutionary domain, like they're saying. It's each epical revelation advances forward. Yeah, you notice that when they qualified that first sentence, revelation is evolutionary, but always progressive. Okay, so unlike the sloshing about of evolution in general, you don't have retrogressive epical revelations, obviously. Although you can have rebellions, but that's only relatively retrogressive. I mean, when we had the rebellion 200,000 years ago, it meant that we basically just erased what had happened for those 300,000 years prior, and you kind of start it over again. It's not like it drives it, lower than where things started. It blows up, and everything kind of goes back into the sloshing about evolutionary mode. Okay, so there's that part, that overarching over all the revelations. It's quote unquote evolutionary. But then when they say, but, that subsequent sentence there, but if revelation is to exalt and upstep the religions of evolution, then must such divine visitations portray teachings which are not too far removed from the thought and reactions of the age in which they are presented. Okay, that's the sentence that you can sum up, that you take a particular revelation, that revelation is evolutional. Not evolutionary, but it's evolutional. It's precisely synchronized to match up with the state of the evolutionary system at that place and time. Okay, that's what I'm summing up when you hear me say revelation is evolutional. There's a sentence like that. You could use that word evolutional in even a more generalized sense, and it would encompass both of those statements in both ways, that it's synchronized with evolution, and that's what they do towards the end. Thus must and does revelation always keep in touch with evolution, right? So in every way, shape, and form, in other words, there's nothing revolutionary about genuine revelation. If it were revolutionary instead of, you know, evolutionary, evolutional, it would be rebellion. Because it is personalities, you know, inserting themselves into the system. And if they put their perspective above the whole of the finite, if they aren't completely humble relative to the supremacy of the whole of the finite, that's rebellion. Okay? And we all know how that plays out. But of course, you know, even though they think that they're not subject to that, everything is, right? The supreme mind that encompasses all these finite facts takes whatever foolish thing they had in their heads and whatever foolish consequences it produced and just, you know, uses it, you know, in the only way it can use anything, like we saw there, but always progressive. No matter what any individual does, there's an influence that's transcendent that can always progress with that set of facts. The most horrendous thing that you can imagine being done, right, it's just a finite horror, right? Supremacy yawns, okay, just takes it forward, it takes no cleverness whatsoever from a supremacy vantage point to do something positive with that, no matter what it is. That should take a little, you know, bit of a burden off your shoulders. You know, we tend to beat ourselves up a lot if we fall short of our ideals in a particular situation. Okay, it's like no real harm has befallen the universe. It's okay, okay? Sure, you have learned from your mistakes, do better, but you know, don't endlessly beat yourself up about it. You know, if the supreme mind can quickly make all sorts of goodness out of the Lucifer rebellion, you know, you're not going to do anything that even remotely reaches that level of of throwing an ugly rock into a beautiful, placid pond. Okay. All right. Let's see here. Yeah, you got a question?
I do. Divine visitation. Mm-hmm. Now, so to me, that says that the Urantia book is actually a divine visitation. And then I remember Dr. Meredith Sprunger, you know, calling it such and says, you know, that because of that, you know, you got to act, got to do something.
Mm-hmm.
For heaven's sake, do something. But, you know, as opposed to the others, which are, so we say, personality driven, this one is, is written by a lot of personalities, but it's a book.
Right.
So to speak.
Right.
But do you, so, you know, we talk a lot about not being a sacred book and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe I'm just semantics, but the divine visitation to me is a fairly, I don't know if sacred is the right word, but it carries a lot of meaning.
Right, and I mean, and remember, even though...
Do you know where I'm confused?
Yes, yeah, I mean, even though it doesn't appear to be as much of a literal divine visitation, as they say there, as, say, Jesus of Nazareth or Machiavelli or Melchizedek, remember, don't forget, it was. I mean, every author had to literally visit this planet, had to literally come to this planet, and, you know, they visited here. You know, they didn't speak to you directly by jiggling air molecules. They saw to it that their words got written down and handed to you. Right? But it is still literally a visitation. And...
I think they had to prepare.
Of course, they, you know.
Even their way of preparing is a whole lot.
Yeah, I mean, a very, very high being can, you know, can completely, you know, prepare in an instant, you know. But still, right, there's no magical beings. Right? They all have to prepare in some way. I mean, you know, who knows? You know, some of them might have been doing a project like this for the second or third time or something. You know, it could have been other emergency projects like this, other places. Especially when you're talking about super universe beings, there's a lot of worlds in a super universe. There's lots of possibilities. You know, that would even prepare them for, you know, this subsequent mission. But yeah, again, just, you know, to appreciate that they all, no matter how far over they had to come from, I mean, they made the trek. You know, and for beings that... that don't have super high speeds like those, you know, Trinity origin beings like a Divine Counselor or, you know, or a Solitary Messenger or something like that, you know, they've got to be carted in a Transport Seraphim or whatever, three times the speed of light max, you know, and that is, could have been a long journey to get here.
Even right? Divine Counselor.
Taking them many, 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 many years. Right?
Yeah, that's a lot of planning.
He's saying none.
No, the Divine Counselors are Trinity origin beings, so you know, they go really fast, okay? but you know, when you're talking about, you know, beings that aren't Trinity origin, so they can't self, you know, transport. Remember, the reason that we can self-transport when we, you know, when we're a finaliter is because of that identification of the Trinity that we have.
Yeah.
It allows us to self-transport. And, you know, so as we stem from that identification with the Paradise Trinity and going out, you know, what else stems from the Paradise Trinity? The Mother Deity, right? So we go out, God the Mother revealing. See, it's all coordinated in that way. But anyway, this was, for a lot of these beings, this was a huge thing. I mean, just to get here, and then all the preparation they'd have to do, and I mean, think of how much work the Midwayers did. You know, they're kind of doing it, you know, just barely above our level of understanding. You know, if we were handed that project, and they have to sort through all the stuff and, you know, try to decide what to use and how to use it, and you know, they can't just go, okay, I've just, you know, got everything that humans have ever thought in my head, you know, like a Divine Counselor does. You know, they've got to plod through it more linearly like we do. So there's a whole spectrum of how long it took to prepare and how long it just took to get here. And, and then I'm sure there's all kinds of, you know, within a particular revelatory commission, you know, there's those three different commissions. They've got to get themselves all together and coordinated, and you know, as a committee, as a group, and figure that out. I mean, it's a big project, but they're doing that here as a visitation. And now, not every one of those beings, you know, is an innately divine being, okay? Like say a Melchizedek, yeah, you know, it's not innately divine, but they're all very appropriate in one way or another, and they're working in a group context where effectively you have a divine visitation. But you don't have, the problem with sacred texts is, this was written by God himself channeling through some prophet or something, you know. It's not like that. It's a group of people with all that logistics that I was just talking about. Okay.
It kind of seems like it is, the fifth revelation is far removed from the thought and reactions of the age in which we live, right?
Yes, right. Yeah, and why don't we just talk about that up front rather than in the context of when we get to the fifth precisely. We've talked about this a lot, that this all seems very strange. You study this, it's like, well, wait a minute. I mean, this thing talks about master architects, and they tell you normally those aren't revealed, you know, until the local universe is settled in light and life. And it's like, what are they talking about? This just seems to be a total rebellion. Well, you know, everything got thrown into a complete wild card sort of status when Michael decided to just break the normal order of things and whatnot. And it's in the context of him exercising his now supreme sovereignty of the local universe that he can, allow for something like this to happen and it not be rebellion on the part of those that are doing it. I mean, normally, technically, this is kind of what Caligastia did. Caligastia wasn't trying to make everyone bad. He was trying to get them to skip all the steps and let's just do light and life stuff right now. You know, let's just give you a whole bunch of stuff way in advance of what you normally get it and when you normally get it. I mean, that's just technically what Lucifer and Caligastia and all those people wanted to do, is what the fifth epical revelation seems to be doing. And so, see, if you really think about it, it's like, why isn't this rebellion? And that's the reason, because everything got so changed that the Melchizedeks had to set up a special college just to try to sort through the consequences of this. It's like, well, okay, this is, you know, this blows up everything. Basically, Michael has decided that, coloring outside of the lines is okay.
He must have the approval of the Ancients of Days.
Yeah, right. I mean, they're talking, yeah. Yeah, but of course, see, I mean, once he's a master son, you know, it's sort of just is, he's kind of like Yul Brynner, so let it be written, so let it be done, you know. He just decrees it. It's a very interesting thing to think about. See, I mean, he doesn't have a grand universe-sized supreme perspective as a master son, but he has taken his local universe scale perspective up to the supreme level. And so he has a vantage point there where, kind of the end from the beginning sort of a vantage point that allows him to know that things that, lesser beings would never dare do, that it's okay. Now, I'm sure there's still many things that would have been rebellious. And that's all outlined in, the documents that all these revelators got. Okay, you can say this, but not this, and, okay. There are lines still that they could cross, right? And it's always delightful when you can see where they're right up against some line, and they'd love to give you just one, so they're like hinting, and it's like, okay, I can't tell you what it looks like on the other side of the line, but can you guess if I give you the shape of the boundary between where you are and where what's over there that I'd like you to tell you about? I mean, they just get really suggestive. And
down the bottom, we're not.
Okay.
That's right. You
can't
really tell you this, but
that's what you're talking about. One of the easiest ones to do is, this has nothing directly to do with life. hint. All right. So, there's obviously, they could have said things that, would have been rebellious, would have been in violation of the integrity of the whole. I'm sure most of the universe was startled at what Michael said was okay to talk about.
They were proscriptions, weren't they?
Yeah.
Their guidelines?
Yeah.
And was that Michael's?
Well, he would have been involved in some way. I mean, they don't give you any hints about. Yeah, I mean, not only is he master, son, but he's obviously also he's the titular planetary prince. It's very fun to just pause and consider. How far out of the normal lines, we'll talk about that a little bit as we go forward here too, out of the lines, the normal lines, some of this stuff is. So, you don't have to have a Melchizedek's perspective on this to kind of put yourself in their shoes and be, oh my goodness gracious, we're going to have to form a whole new college to try to deal with the consequences of this. I mean, because this is... they're thinking, oh my goodness, this is like Pandora's box is being opened up here. This is going to affect everything. How are we going to regulate all this? So it's a huge deal.
Probably had fun doing it.
Right? Yeah.
420 council.
Yeah.
It
was complicated enough, when Michael, skipped the magisterial son and did what he did. And this is just, doing that on steroids. This is just doubling down on that. We're going to just go kind of seemingly full wild card here.
We wonder why we can't figure it out.
We've talked some about one of the consequences this is going to have. It's not all sunshine and lollipops. When you give people something kind of that's, definitively challenging where they are, that is a serious double-edged sword in play. So, but we know about that. I mean, that's both Michael and the Creative Mother Spirit have decided they want to try to get the bad stuff out of the system as fast as possible. So they want that negative edge of the sword, if you will, to cut deeply and quickly. Right?
We basically killed God. They know how bad it can get.
Right. Let's get this evil and sin out of their system, as quickly as possible. So, this just adds to that. I mean, as this goes forward in time, it will likely lead to some very intense downward spirals. But it's like Jesus said, that's the way truth is. Right? 60% are going to go down the drain, and 40% go forward.
Was it that high?
Yeah, I remember it's 3/5 and 2/5 is the example he gives, right? Yeah, and remember when we went through the rebellion, we saw that, that literal 60-40 thing playing out occasionally, so just like Jesus said. So, you don't want to have, rose-colored glasses on about this. This is not going to just lead to, wonderful bliss on the planet, in the near term. Just like Jesus said, what I'm doing here 2,000 years ago, this isn't going to lead to universal bliss, right? Same thing is true here. So don't be surprised if some very ugly, dark things manifest from it. We talk about all the time how easy it would be to abuse some of the things that are said in here. Okay? Back to the paragraph. See, that paragraph is very systematically laying out how things are in a normal sort of a mode, especially synchronized. But even with all of the outside of the normal lines, we still talk all the time about how this is so designed to synchronize. I mean, they use so many Bible quotes, for instance. They wouldn't have to use any Bible quotes, but they use lots and lots of Bible quotes, and they may tweak them a little bit and stuff. All that is to make it as evolutional as possible, right? To meet us where we are, as we are, as well as possible. So you want to, set aside all of those biases that you might have had about the word revelation, that are really because of the Kalagastia secession. I mean, it's not revolution. you say you want a revolution, well, you're not looking for revelation then, okay?
I'm a revelationist.
Yes.
I
Yeah. And of course, see, like they're pointing out, you know, like they tell you directly in the book, a revelationist is an evolutionist. And you should think about that. You know, bring in some self-control so that it is that way within you. Oh, I know. Just one other thing we should say up front here, how this ties into what we stressed back in, last week. Remember how Revelation feeds into the Moray system? And then that so slowly influences evolutionary religion. It doesn't go directly to evolutionary religion. Again, see, you have to think very holistically, patiently, evolutionarily, right, about synchronizing with that Moray system. You know, if you want to be an evangel of the fourth or the fifth epical revelation. Don't think in revolutionary terms. Okay, what else do they give us here?
But regardless of apparent connection or derivation, the religions of Revelation are always characterized by a belief in some deity of final value and in some concept of the survival of personality identity after death.
Okay, so a little footnote to the preceding paragraph, since it starts with but. Okay, so that paragraph starts with, you know, as a that contrasting word, so it's gonna be constructed in this evolutional way, but that doesn't mean it's going to be so watered down that it doesn't have any substance to it anymore. Okay, I mean, you know, if they're engaging a people in a revelatory fashion that have no real concept of deity per se at all in their evolutionary religion, they're going to get some concept of deity, you know, slipped in under their radar or whatever, right? So, I mean, it's going to have some necessary substance, specifically like they're saying. Belief in some deity and survival of personality identity after death. However, that's couched to be evolutional, but they're going to get something. Right? It's going to be progressive in nature, not progressivist, but progressive in nature. And the other thing we should now they've kind of completed that thought. Don't take statements like we've just read here out of context so that you think that all the fifth epical revelation is about is revealed religion. When they're talking like that, the religions of Revelation, for instance, as we just read there. Okay. We're reading a paper, it's the later evolution of religion. We're talking about religion here, okay? They're just emphasizing the religious part of Revelation. And in the case of the fifth epical revelation, I mean, there is so much more than just addressing religion to it. Unlike, more than any of the previous four epical revelations, this has produced a philosophic product, relative to the fourth epical revelation. I mean, as a spiritual uplifter, he wasn't trying to produce a philosophic product. He was trying to be very focused on religion. Obviously, the prince and his staff and Adam and Eve would have focused on a lot more than just religion. Those had played out properly. They would have been a lot more like the sweeping inclusiveness of the fifth epical revelation. and of course, again, Machaventa was just presaging the fourth, so he was very focused on the spiritual too. Yeah, so we have this bias because of the preceding two epical revelations, and then just other biases that we bring to bear that it can get you to think that you're just reading a religious text and you find parts that aren't religious in the book very weird, you have a false assumption. It's not a religious text. It's a philosophic text. Yeah.
And some scientific.
Yeah, right. Well, and see, science and religion are within the sphere of that greater philosophic context. That's the whole point. It talks about religion. It talks about science, but not, you know, as island universes in some way. No, it talks about them in a philosophic context. When it really focuses on the nature of religion, right, in papers 99 through 103, you go, why does the word philosophy occur so often in these papers? I thought these were the religion papers, quote unquote, right? No, they're about true religion. You can't have true religion until you have the philosophic context first. Religion is not a complete lifestyle solution. It's an element of the whole. It's not the whole.
And there's the whole eternal salvation part.
Right, yeah, and then all those issues of, you know, that are a little bit more, you know, individual in nature about your, you know, salvation, right? And so much of evolutionary religion, you know, like they're pointing out, you know, even when it's revelation, it has to address the survival of personality, identity after death, because so much of, you know, of evolutionary religion is fixated on that fear of death, and like we've read and everything. Yeah. So, of course. But, you know, if you think that this book is just about survival after death, you're really struggling to figure out, well, what does that have to do with a Tyrannosaurus or, you know, or a brachiopod, you know, or what does that have to do with automatons and who cares about Omnifem, you know, or whatever. Okay, what else do they give us as a little predicate here?
Evolutionary religion is sentimental, not logical. It is man's reaction to belief in a hypothetical ghost spirit world. The human belief reflex, excited by the realization and fear of the unknown. Revelatory religion is propounded by the real spiritual world. It is the response of the super-intellectual cosmos to the mortal hunger to believe in and depend upon the universal deities. Evolutionary religion pictures the circuitous gropings of humanity in quest of truth. Revelatory religion is that very truth.
Okay, that's a fun paragraph. It's got all kinds of cool things in it. So let's kind of step through it.
No gloves on.
So evolutionary religion is sentimental, not logical. In other words, evolutionary religion doesn't exist in this wonderfully bestowed, integrous philosophic frame. If it was like that, it would be logical. Okay, but it's not. It's only as logical as a little bit of a faint flicker of personal nature kind of unwittingly trickles into it from the humans. Yeah, and we all know that not only is evolutionary religion sentimental, for some so-called religionists, you know, evolutionary religionists, you know, that's all they think religion is sentimentalism, right? And so, you know, they look for someone on the planet that makes sentiment a complete lifestyle solution, and they call them a saintly religionist. Like, well, okay, not really. That's a sentimentalist. They, you know, if you examine them closely, you probably won't see any sign of genuine religion at all. Right? You won't see any sign of them being unshakable in the face of severe testing, right? Like a genuine religionist is. Right? You'll find someone, you know, that the moment the going gets tough, they're, you know, curled up in the fetal position, you know, desperately praying for the magic man to fix things. Okay. Of course, that has the context as a child of God and all that, like we've talked about, but still, you know, that's not a genuinely religious person. The genuinely religious person is someone that behaves completely unnaturally to rigorous external stressing. Right? Takes endless blows, seem to just keep right on going, like totally unfazed, right? And you go, well, they're not a religionist. You know, they're not sentimental at all. No, that doesn't make them a religionist. A genuine religionist, the fact that they stand unmoved, that makes them a genuine religionist. Okay? And, you know, they're likely to not meet any of your expectations, you know, none of your check boxes that you have for, oh, that's a religionist, you know, you won't check off any of those boxes. You know, but that's the genuine religionist.
And then when they don't, you're
going to
be cringing in the corner.
Right? You know, all right, so there's that. Now, that's a very sweeping statement. That's for a simple little sentence. And then they stress. See, again, just in one sentence, giving you the whole sweep of what we've been studying for months now. You know, it's all just the ghost cult frame, right? Right? All this stuff. It is man's reaction to belief in a hypothetical ghost spirit world. Whatever particular flavor of rationalization, you know, in that frame. Those that are so-called different religions. You know, even everything Jesus said all got sucked down into that morass of the ghost cult. Notice the other little technical thing they do in there when they say it's this human belief reflex excited by the realization and fear of the unknown. I want to just remind you there of the order. It doesn't say fear and realization. It says realization and fear. To remind you of kind of how this paper started. You have that basic foundational adjutant aggrandized fear. But then you have an encirclement in the Holy Spirit on top of that that can realize something. Without the encirclement in the Holy Spirit, nothing can be realized. No animal can realize anything. They have sensation recognition, okay, but they don't have realization in the way the revelators use the word realization. They can't realityize anything. They have no reality response to use properly or improperly or whatever. Right? They have no encirclement in the Holy Spirit. That's basically saying, you know, foundationally you have adjutant mind, and on top of that, that realization, on top of that you have the encirclement of the Holy Spirit. That's just reminding you of the preface of the paper. Okay. You know, and all about the unknown, right? And when you finally get to really fancy religions of the mind, it's God is the unknowable, right? And all of that foolishness. And then they say, okay, now in contrast, revelatory religion, you know, is propounded by the real spiritual world. You know, and that's a challenge right there. You say, oh, I believe this is a revelation. Okay, now be careful there. Are you thinking that this book came from those so-called spirit beings in the ghost cult that humans have always believed in? No, it didn't come from any of those beings. None of those imaginary beings, right? Right, the revelation may call some beings angels, but those aren't the angels of the ghost cult. Those imaginary beings in the ghost cult scheme, okay, buxom winged things, for instance, okay, seraphim aren't those. all these things. We're talking about the gift of revelation, but just notice up front they're trying to get you, okay. The word revelation is a very loaded word. You know, you're not going to properly interpret that word until you've completely reformed yourself out of the ghost cult, right? And you've stopped identifying with every human's usage of that word throughout all of human history. And you can't say, oh, it's another one of those like so-and-so said. No, okay? It's genuine revelation. Not so-called revelation. And then when they say, you know, it is the response of the super intellectual cosmos to the mortal hunger, et cetera there. Don't falsely interpret that. It's not that this is coming from some cosmos that's above mind. No, there's a mindedness in the cosmos. Yeah, what's the super intellectual, the above intellectual? What intellect are we talking about? The cosmos' intellect? No, your human's intellect, right? It's above you know, it's coming from above something that's being generated within human minds. Like evolutionary religion, it's all being generated in human minds. Revelation is coming from above such human mind generation. No matter how fancy it is, you know, that you might want to call it intellectual. Okay, so there's that. It's coming from above human minds. And then that final statement about, you know, the obvious circuitous gropings that we've been studying about for months again, all the preceding papers, all sorts of curious things that developed and whatnot as we grope around in the dark and back into the truth and whatnot like we talked about. Okay, but Revelation is, right, the truth. Okay? And I don't have to, you know, just talk about revelatory religion. I could speak, you know, in general. Right? Revelation is revelation of truth. That's fundamentally what revelation is. It's not disclosure of facts. If there's disclosure of facts, that's incidental. That's secondary to the revelation. Right? It's not trying to give you facts first and foremost. It's trying to give you that element of the cosmos that humans have been unable to define throughout all human history. Quid est veritas. That's what it's trying to give you. See, that makes it even a greater challenge. And I stress that one all the time, right? I mean, think about that. This book is literally dedicated to giving you something that humans have never been able to figure out what it is. The dictionary does not tell you what truth is. And no human has ever talked about it properly. Okay? Like we saw, the truth is basically imprisoned in the ghost cult frame as correct understanding, quote unquote. That's what we think truth is. And that's why we say things like, well, that's your truth, my truth, blah, 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 right? Yeah, that's your understanding, but the correct understanding, yeah, it is my truth. Right? You see, that's the way humans use that word, you know, at best. I mean, sometimes they don't even use it that, and they just use it as a substitute for fact, say. Okay, very confused.
Yeah, so, what you get is, well, how do you know?
Yeah, right. You know, and the response is, how do you not know? Real humans know truth. Fancy animals can't.
Ouch.
That's the facts of it. Right? If you dismiss truth, you're just testifying that you've not yet discovered genuine human consciousness. You're just resting upon your super conscious humanity laurels. You know, you're human in spite of yourself. Okay? If you think that God is a delusion or that there is no such thing as truth, that's a fancy animal. Okay? No real conscious human can dismiss the fact of God. It's just a triviality before your eyes as a genuine human. It's as clear as a hand in front of your face if you're human of mind. Right? And that's not me saying that. You know that. They say that point blank with great poetic flourish, in the religion papers. Right? I mean, the fact of God is the most trivially knowable thing for someone who really knows anything, really knows anything. Right.
If they're Pope,
like,
well, how do you know I don't know?
Right, exactly. Right, all those responses. It's like you know, it's just you just turn it back. You know, if they're going to be really prickly about it, just turn it back with a little bit of a poke. How do you not know? Right. Everyone who's anyone in the eyes of Gabriel knows such things. Gabriel, why don't you intervene, you know, against these sophistries? It's like, well, if you can't see through that sophistry, I can't help you, dude. There's none so blind as those who will not see. That is trivially transparent, what he's saying. If that's not trivially transparent to you, there's not much I can do for you, son. All right? That is just so patently absurd, what he's saying. All right? You know, he's going all the way up, you know, from solipsism up through anarchism up to nihilism. And, of course, in the context of nihilism, obviously there is no God. Seriously, the most trivially obvious thing in existence is God. So he's taken his great thoughts and his final culminating conclusion is there is no God. That is the most extreme reductio ad absurdum that you can produce. Anyone who has any personal consciousness can see through that. And if you can't, okay, you're not real. Right? This is what Gabriel says. That's what you're dealing with. Like, yeah. Sure, I know he's really fancy being, and he can throw up a fancy fog, but come on. You have eyes to see through the densest fog like that, okay? All right, don't be befogged by his much thinking. Okay? All right, that's limiting yourself to the ignorance of others. Right? So these are the facts of reality and just coming to terms with that. I mean, just saying that, knowing, even if you haven't achieved that yourself, know that that's what you're looking for. That sort of certitude. Right? That's the certitude of the divine. Right? That's what you're looking for. Don't accept anything less. Okay. Don't accept a bunch of fancy words from some priest in the ghost cult. Okay. All right, so anyway, back to that sentence. We were talking about religion. Revelatory religion is that very truth. Right. That's what revelation is truth.
Coordination of essential knowledge before revelation.
Yeah,
truth.
Yeah.
It's the truth is the core.
Right. The truth is the foundation, in a top-down sense of what we're trying to get at here. Okay, so that's our predicate. Really, just lay out the basic substance of revelation, genuine revelation. Now, let's consider one at a time these five epical revelations that have been bestowed on this world. Just read that little preface sentence and I'm going to make one little comment first.
There have been many events of religious revelation, but only five of epical significance. These were as follows.
The reason I want to just pause there, okay, the word epical. I want to make sure you're not just blowing through that word. Oh, I love to say that word. It sounds cool. Okay, what's it? Why are they calling them epical revelations? Okay, an epic is the fact of the beginning of an age. Right? There's been five of epical significance, five that have launched a whole long, vast, universal on the planet age. Okay, that's why they're epical. Not because they're like really cool, they're epic, dude, or not like that.
That might be cool. Okay. Drug into the
yeah, and of course, three of the five, that age that it was inaugurating, is that very official dispensation age. Right? They're launching a whole new dispensation on the planet. The other two are emergencies. So they're not. So that age is not a dispensation that they're launching, but nonetheless, they are a sweeping, of sweeping at least potential consequence. They are epical. Right? They're meant. They're at the very least meant to launch something that will eventually impact the whole context of the globe. Okay. I mean, it's not a local emergency. It's a plan. It's a global emergency. Right? So those emergency ones are still trying to address a global scale phenomenon.
Yep. So just because it, I mean, is this fit in there? I learned the order epic age era, and so it's the beginning of that,
and then yeah, the, and you know, when we look at those, you know, those dispensational you know, blocks of time that we, you know, we talk about, and they use that, they use those three words in that sequence of epic age era, right? That's just simply because age is sort of the kind of the neutral word, so you stick it in the middle of the three, you know, and it sort of just speaks to the, you know, being in the middle of the age. Epic is pointing to the beginning, and when you use the word era, it's a word that is indicating that you're summing up the whole thing. So it's a, you know, it appropriately is used as a third word. You know, it's, you know, it's not exactly right, you know, like epic, only about the end, right? But it's, but it has that wrapping it all up sort of in the full era, see? Yeah. So that's why they use them in that, you know, because it's kind of a beginning, middle, end usage of the three words. So to say epic age era. okay. But anyway, so that's what, you know, so there's five that are launching this, you know, grand new phenomenon of epical significance. Okay, what's the first one?
One, the Dalmatian teachings. The true concept of the first source and center was first promulgated on Urantia by the 100 corporeal members of Prince Caligastia's staff. This expanding revelation of deity went on for more than 300,000 years, until it was suddenly terminated by the planetary succession and the disruption of the teaching regime. Except for the work of Van, the influence of the Dalmatian revelation was practically lost to the whole world. Even the Nadites had forgotten this truth by the time of Adam's arrival. Of all who received the teachings of the 100, the red men held them the longest, but the idea of the Great Spirit was but a hazy concept in Amerindian Indian religion when contact with Christianity greatly clarified and strengthened it.
Right, so when, you know, the fact that, that when they say Great Spirit, you go, oh yeah, I've heard that. And they're reminding you of why you've heard that expression. That's only because that sort of got brought up out of the forgotten mists of Amerindian consciousness when they got exposed to Christianity. You know, and, oh, wait a minute, I think we know what they're basically talking about. They're talking about the Great Spirit, right? And you had this revival, you know, of Great Spiritism, as it were, amongst the Amerindians, you know, back in the day, especially in the 1800s. But, you know, they weren't keeping that Great Spirit thing alive. That got revivified by being threatened by Christianity. Okay, so notice there, you know, right before that, when they say even the Nadites had forgotten this truth, right? It's the first epical revelation of truth, okay? And it's more important to think about how the truth was forgotten rather than what facts had been forgotten. The truth that they had gotten people to have a beginning synchronization with, that was lost. That's the most important thing. Not that they forgot some factoid. Okay? Like, you know, what's the best way to, you know, to treat a certain disease or how to handle sewage or whatever. Okay? Okay. Okay, and the other thing about this is the planetary prince is not, you know, the official title of the first epical revelation. You know, the prince's staff is not the title. Okay, it's the teachings. The first epical revelation is the Dalmatian teachings. The teachings are the revelation, not a person. See, so that's a, you know, see, a lot, like we said, you know, those first two are a lot more like the fifth epical revelation, right? In that they were, you know, giving this very broad spectrum of teachings. So those teachings were the revelation. You know, the biologic uplift of the second or the civilizational uplift of the first. Okay, those in and of themselves aren't, you know, precisely the, you know, the revelation. You know, especially when we get to the next one, those, that biologic uplift. I mean, obviously, the teachings are, you know, that's fairly directly related to us trying to be a civilizational uplifter. I mean, the fifth epical revelation is trying to be a civilizational uplifter, right? I mean, you know, invariably, there's a, you know, there's a close relationship between true recognition of truth and civilization. Okay, but don't, you know, don't just think, oh, the first epical revelation, that's civilizational uplift. The second epical revelation, that's biologic uplift. And no, that's not the proper way to think about it. Okay, it's it, there's a holistic set of teachings in both cases. Those are the revelation. You know, obviously a lot of that was spoken, but, you know, even in the first epoch, it wasn't all just spoken. Some of it was written down, right? Like the Seven Commandments got chiseled onto little stones that we could still dig up if we knew where to dig in the Persian Gulf, right, for instance, right? Okay, so, you know, there's some similarities to the fifth epical revelation with that. Okay, then the other little thing to highlight there is how it begins. The true concept of the first source and center was first promulgated on Urantia by the 100 corporeal members of Prince Kaligash's staff. Okay, now wait a minute. No, it wasn't, you say. I've read the Urantia book. They weren't talking about the true concept of the first source and center. Well, not when you use the word true in the old ghost cult or corrupted sense, no. Right? They weren't giving some precise factual description of the literal first source and center, you know, blah, 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 you know, like you were studying paper 105 or something, okay? True concept, right? You know, they were, they weren't revealing the first source and center in fact, but they were in truth, which is straightforward since revelation is revelation of truth, after all, not disclosure of fact. Okay. Now, in a more factual mode, they were giving a God concept that was of local system scale. You know, effectively, this God was the system sovereign. Okay. You know, remember how that works with the first epical revelation on a world. It's, you know, it's kind of up to that local system level. Right. So, in other words, the Father in heaven, you know, is basically a concept like the system sovereign. Not any grander than that, because the, you know, the primitive minds can't encompass some grander scheme than that. That's plenty, you know, big for them to wrap their minds around, a system sovereign. I mean, you know, there's eventually 1,000 inhabited worlds in a local system. Okay, that's a pretty big thing for some little primitive, you know. Yeah, right. Tribal person to wrap their mind around. Okay, that's effectively infinity for them, right? Like John said, they can't even, you know, if they kind of just fuzz out in infinity when, but before they get to three, one, two, oh, I'm losing it. Oh, it's in, you know, in many. All right. Okay. So that's, you know, notice that. Notice those modifiers of true, and properly interpret those sentences. Okay, what about number two?
Two, the Edenic teachings. Adam and Eve again portrayed the concept of the Father of all to the evolutionary peoples. The disruption of the first Eden halted the course of the Adamic revelation before it had ever fully started. But the aborted teachings of Adam were carried on by the Sethi priests, and some of these truths have never been entirely lost to the world. The entire trend of Levantine religious evolution was modified by the teachings of the Sethites, but by 2500 BC, mankind had largely lost sight of the revelation sponsored in the days of Eden.
And just to deal with that last fact first. So in other words, by about 2500 BC, so it was getting dicey. The Melchizedek receivers are noticing. It's like, okay, this is really fuzzing out and down. And there's not going to be anything here by the time Michael shows up. We're going to need to do something to try to, you know, give the planet a booster shot. And as we're going to read in the subsequent papers, and get into the next block, and in 1980 BC, so not too long after this 2500, in 1980 BC, Machiavanti Melchizedek was incarnated, gave us that booster shot. Yeah, that's the next one we'll read about here. But okay, but back to this. Again, you saw them talking about, and some of these truths have never been entirely lost to the world. And again, to try to think, I can think about maybe some facts. Like when we read about the actual first garden, we noticed how some of the things in this story in Genesis, actually, they hadn't totally lost some of the details, the factual details. No, they're not talking about facts like that. Okay, but the truths. Some of these truths have never been touched. So just try to challenge yourself. What elements of truths that were in the Edenic teachings continued on? What truths of eternity, not facts of time? And we're not going to go into that discussion right now, but that's what they're encouraging you to try to think about. Okay, what things tied to eternity have not been totally lost? Not what things tied to time have been forgotten. And again, like we already pointed out, these are the Edenic teachings. The teachings, not Adam and Eve, not biologic uplift, is the second epical revelation. The Edenic teachings. And of course, even more so than with the rebellion, like they're saying, they hadn't even gotten started hardly, when the default occurred. So this was totally blown up. That makes it even more amazing that there's still some truth that's continuing on from that. That's how aborted that was. Notice again in the beginning, Adam and Eve again portrayed the concept of the Father of all to the evolutionary peoples. Okay, again, they weren't talking factually about the first source and center of all things and beings, tied to the Isle of Paradise or anything like that. Okay. But the truth of the Father of all. Okay, and in this case, though, we take the all up a notch. Right? So it isn't quite so parochial, right, as just the local system. It's effectively constellation size and scope. Okay? It starts local system size, then it goes second epical revelation on every world. It goes to a constellation size. So in other words, not the system sovereign now, but the constellation father. Or maybe the constellation fathers, if you want to do it in threefold. Okay. It goes up to the constellation level. Okay. Now, ask yourself just a little question, especially if I'd like to remember this. How can I remember it? Okay, it makes complete sense. Okay. So you have a planet, when you establish a planetary prince, okay, so as a planetary prince on a world, as you look up to the next rung up, or whatever you want to say, the next notch up, who's up there? The system sovereign. Okay. So from the perspective of a world, right, the heavens, or the all, right, is the system sovereign. The Father of all is the system sovereign. If you're a material son and daughter, right, they come from Gerasim. Right, so the system sovereign's at eye level. Who's the next notch up? Right, the constellation father. Okay. So they reveal that context, from the vantage point of where we come from, right, the ceiling, the immediate ceiling is the constellation. Okay. And then normally a magisterial son, would come, and, they come from Paradise, but there's a set of them that are brought into a local universe under the Creator Son, Right? And so when they reveal, right, the ceiling that they're under, right, it's the local universe, you know, level.
So all the ones that came before Michael came here, to all those other worlds, were doing that. Magisterial sons that came together.
Yeah.
Pre-worlds throughout the local
world. Right, yeah. I mean, so it's on a normal post-Adamic magisterial mission. Their father of all concept is expanded so that it's local universe sized. It has that kind of a scope to it, which is now getting, you know, they can literally kind of say, very directly, as you look with your eyes at all the stars above you in the sky, that's the domain of the Father of all. That's the local universe. Just to kind of keep on this, see, what's the next notch? The next notch is, normally you have a bestowal son. Well, a bestowal son could be a creator son. Right, so it would obviously, if it's a creator son, what's his ceiling? Well, the super universe level. See, so they would reveal up to the Ancients of Days as, the fathers of all. Right? See, so again, and then if you go to the Trinity teacher sons, obviously you're going to go all the way, right, to the actual universal father. You're going to go to the full scope. But see, that it's very logical sequence. And it's just whoever is revealing, they're kind of just giving you, relative to them, their immediate ceiling. And they're giving that as the allness, context. Yeah.
Jesus.
Yeah, now, right, I mean, let's go ahead and just say it right now. Okay, we didn't get a magisterial son. As we're about to read, the next thing we got was, that emergency incarnation of Machiavendi Melchizedek. Okay, he's not starting a new dispensation, so he just continues in the previous mode of the Most High constellation scale. And again, even though it's a creator son coming as a bestowal son, okay, I mean, he's doing it all out of order. So, I mean, he just basically, when he's talking about your spiritual father, he's, and occasionally he literally says the Most High. He keeps it still basically in the Adam and Eve context of Most High. He doesn't push it. And then we just blow up everything with the fifth epical revelation, reveal it all the way to the genuine first source and center and infinitely beyond that. Right? It's like you think that's a big scale. Let's go infinitely beyond that. Right? Let's make the seven absolutes of infinity be insignificantly small in an even more infinite context. And right. So the fifth epical revelation just, blows all the doors off.
That's where everyone's gasping.
Right. Basically, you were still trying to wrap your mind around Jesus' Most High, Father concept. And then they just, give you this, and you're just, stymied, trying to wrap your mind around what the heck they're talking about. okay, after a rebellion and default, it's all just, in total shambles here. So an emergency. We're going to get an epical revelation that's not a dispensational beginning. It's the beginning of dealing with an emergency, dealing with the exigencies of an emergency. Okay, what's that one?
3. Melchizedek of Salem. This emergency son of Nebadon inaugurated the third revelation of truth on Urantia. The cardinal precepts of his teachings were trust and faith. He taught trust in the omnipotent beneficence of God and proclaimed that faith was the act by which men earned God's favor. His teachings gradually commingled with the beliefs and practices of various evolutionary religions and finally developed into those theologic systems present on Urantia at the opening of the first millennium after Christ.
Okay, so that last part, see, it's just like I said, even though it's not inaugurating a new dispensation, it's spread, because of the Melchizedek missionaries that we'll read about, it's spread far and wide. The farther it spread, of course, the more it got diluted and whatnot. But still, it encompassed the globe to some degree. And you know, even some extremely remote places in the middle of Africa and whatnot got touched by the Melchizedek missionaries. And so, you know, their sort of hereditary religion, you know, set aside, you know, Islam or Christianity or whatnot, you know, coming into those areas. You know, if you carefully reflect on it, you'll see slight little hints of the fact that way back in the dim mists of their past, the Melchizedek missionaries said some things to them. Right? And that kind of colored their thoughts a little bit. Okay, but the big thing that stands out here, it's not the teachings of the Sage of Salem. No, the revelation is Machiavendi Melchizedek, Melchizedek of Salem. Right? And it's even more important to actually say it, instead of saying Machiavendi Melchizedek, to say it the way they did. Right? So you know, it's not the teachings of a particular Melchizedek, you know, like I can read some Melchizedek paper in the book here. Right? This is the teachings of a Melchizedek incarnated as a human, getting an adjuster, having a soul, etc. Right? Being, you know, in our kind of modality of mind. Okay, but having a cosmic scope of understanding of things. Right? All right. He is the revelation, right? His, the state of his mind, its encompassment of truth, manifesting out as the fruits of that truth sphere is the revelation, in whatever way that is. Okay, so again, not his teachings, right? Not the precise, you know, diddly z did with Abraham or whatever, okay? But him, he bestowed himself on the world, okay? Not teachings. So that's an interesting thing, and it obviously foreshadows the next epical revelation, right? Because that's why he was doing it. He was doing it for the sake of the next one. So he does it in the same mode as the next one, right? He's not there to bestow a set of teachings. He's there to bestow himself as an example in the midst of mankind.
He's like a change. Just to mention about Melchizedek, for him to undertake this emergency mission and incarnate as a man, that would be the fullness of trust and faith right there.
Mm-hmm.
Especially in this world.
Yeah, right. He's just going to, he's going to go for it. I'm going to, you know, he's not just going to morph his Melchizedek nature into a corporeal manifestation like they can, you know, like they do with the first magisterial mission and, you know, those sorts of things. No, he's going to incarnate, right? He's going to be, you know, true man. Like I said, he's going to get an adjuster. That adjuster is going to copy the upper domain of the hourglass analogy of his mindal self into a literal morantia object of a soul. Okay, and that's going to be glued to his nature forevermore. Right? When he's done, he doesn't just, you know, throw the soul in the garbage can. Right? That's glued to him. He's not a Melchizedek anymore, really. And he's this composite morphed being. Just like Michael's not a creator son anymore, really. He's a totally different substance being. He's got all this different deity glued into him that wasn't there before. Plus, he's got a soul, a human soul, product of an adjuster, right, infused into his being. so, yeah, and of course, like we have in Hebrews, you know, he had no father or mother, right? He is incarnated as an adult, not incarnated as a baby, like Jesus. There's that difference, but he is still incarnated. So he doesn't got to go through the whole developmental process and, you know, the dicey adolescent years and, you know, and that sort of stuff, okay? Like Jesus had to. But.
Genetic selection.
Yeah, right. Yeah. They built a body for him, and he was incarnated into that body.
Did they build it on the planet here?
Yeah, they built it here. Yeah. Yeah, and of course, that's another thing, the whole behind the scenes of, wow, you know, think of, you know, somewhere there was a whole bunch of, you know, literal physical equipment and whatnot that involved, you know, just like building the bodies for the staff, you know, or rematerializing Adam and Eve, you know. I mean, you're talking literal laboratories with literal equipment, and, you know, it isn't some magic finger snap.
I wonder if they created the equipment here, or if they brought it in, or
created it, you know, make it here. You know, you don't want to cart it by slow boat from China, you know, bring it. I mean, yeah, there's no in seraphiming a, you know, some, you know, lab piece of lab equipment. You'd literally have to cart it at sub-light speed, right, across some distance. That's ridiculous.
Where on earth are those lights? Right.
And are there still labs like that? Well, I mean, obviously the, you know, midwares have all kinds of fancy labs and stuff, but but anyway, right. Okay, so then the other important thing is, you know, the italicized trust and faith. Okay, if you want to sum up what he embodied, you know, what he wanted people to see a literal manifestation of, he wanted to manifest the embodiment of trust and faith. And it's important to note the order there. I already kind of keyed you up on the order thing again. Right, the foundational word is faith, and then trust built upon that. Okay. He's, you know, his direct mission is in just that very initiating mode of getting that foundational faith activated, and then beginning to build some trust predicated on that faith. Okay. If you look in the rest of the book, you'll see it always says faith and trust, and not trust and faith, even going forward to the Melchizedek and missionaries and stuff, because you're now thinking Machaventa, you know, manifested the initiation of some genuine faith, not just fancy belief, credulous belief or whatever, but some genuine faith and some trust that can result from that. And then you're going to have a new living faith on that foundation of trust. See, and so going forward, it's faith and trust. And that faith in faith and trust is not the same faith as this one in trust and faith. Right? Because the faith and trust faith is living faith. It's predicated on trust. This is just mere faith. Right? Transcendent belief. So it's important, you know, that he was in a very initiating mode. It's trust and faith. Okay. All right. Let's. How about what he was? Why he did it? Who is he presaging?
4. Jesus of Nazareth. Christ Michael presented for the fourth time to Urantia the concept of God as the universal Father, and this teaching has generally persisted ever since. The essence of his teaching was love and service. The loving worship which a creature son voluntarily gives in recognition of and response to the loving ministry of God his Father. The free will service which such creature sons bestow upon their brethren in the joyous realization that in this service they are likewise serving God the Father.
Okay.
Chris, that's not God the Most High.
Well... I mean, you know, you've got the expression God Most High, you know, or just the Most High.
Father is
the
universal Father.
Right, but see, again, just remember, even though he was, he was talking about your spiritual father and all, you know, and definitely as we read it, we think, you know, literally the universal Father, like there's, you know, like you seem to be literally seeing here. But again, he didn't reveal the universal Father in fact, right? He revealed him in truth, just like the other ones who just revealed him in truth. And he didn't, you've read all of part four. Nowhere in there did he try to say, okay, now let's sit down. Okay, I need to try to understand there's experiential deity and there's existential deity. No, he didn't try to actually get at the literalness of the universal Father directly. He even allowed for the Father, them to think about the Father as someone who is very much tied to temporal affairs and stuff. Yeah, right. Because the Most High is. Right? The Most High is ruling the kingdoms of men, for Pete's sake. I mean, talk about being tied to temporal affairs. And like I said, notice when you're reading through the part four when he literally said Most High. Sometimes. Right? Just overtly keeping it in the Adam and Eve context. And again, see, it's the fourth time of something, the truth of the universal Father, not the fact. An attempt to reveal the direct fact of the universal Father is for the first time in this book. Yeah. It's the fifth of epical revelation of the truth. It's the first epical revelation of the fact. Right? I mean, the book starts out, well, your ideas of God need an upgrade.
Yeah.
Right? Okay. They're far from factual. Far from fact-based. Okay. Now, unlike with Machiaventa, or Melchizedek of Salem, to be precise, Jesus of Nazareth is love and service. Okay? In that order. Right? Not foundationally love and then service predicated on that. No, just trying to get them to de-selfishize a little bit. Okay, let's start with some service. Serve your fellow man. Be willing to, at least get into that mutual self-sacrifice service of a family, in a family sense, a kin sense, that level of brotherly love, that level of kindness. Serve your fellow man. Okay, and then he's trying to get them to think about something besides, what about death? And, am I going to survive death? Okay, instead of just thinking about all these selfish concerns, okay, let's try to tamp that down a bit, get you to focus on service, focus on others. And then I'm going to try to encourage by talking about the spiritual Father instead of the material Father, you to begin to discover genuine love. I'm gonna get you to kind of think about so-called brotherly love, kindness, and then I'm gonna talk about fatherly love, genuine love built upon that foundation of recognizing so-called brotherly love, kindness. Okay. So see, it's love and service, not service and love. It's love and service. So it's just like Machiaventa. It's not faith and trust. It's trust and faith with him. It's this very initiating step with both of them. But then going forward, right, the idea is to flip it around. And, they don't use the expression service and love. They just say loving service. Right, that's what the expression you see all over in the book, loving service. Like that first cosmic fruit of the Spirit when you get towards the end of of part four, okay, loving service, service top down, where you're engaging service from the top down, where you have genuine love as a predicate, right? It's not just feelingful service or sentimental service; it's loving service. Okay, so in both cases, they had tried to initiate minimal, beginning, and then notice how the book, will flip that around. Saying, okay, I'm assuming you've gotten started, you're not grasping up towards love, you've got your feet planted in genuine love now, and now you're going to reach down with your hands and serve. Okay, instead of serving with your feet, you're going to serve with your hands, because your hands are free. Your hands aren't desperately grasping on to try to keep a hold of God anymore, right? And feeling him slip through your fingers. Okay.
Kind of interesting, the crunching of the feet. He was ministering to where he wanted their feet to be.
Yes. Yeah.
And he was doing that with his hands.
Yeah. Yeah, you can just see how it can kind of flip those sort of simple things around like that and get you to think about it more truthfully instead of just the superficial fact of it, dirty feet, you know, and you wash them. No, it's, and the point is not such crude factual sorts of things. Right, so it's a deeper thing he's trying to, you know, that's trying to be a symbol of, trying to suggest. Okay, and again, like Melchizedek of Salem, the revelation, even though it says, you know, and his teaching has generally persisted. Okay, but the revelation is not his teachings. Right? He's the revelation. Jesus of Nazareth is the title of the revelation, the name of the revelation. Right? His living faith is the revelation. Okay? And again, you know, you've heard me stress that. It's so important. And it's just right here. That's the revelation, right? The teachings are wonderful, okay? But remember, those are secondary. I mean, the literal revelation of truth is not immediately in his teachings. It's in him.
Behold the man.
Behold the man, right? Jesus the man, right? Is the title of the first section in the last paper, right? He's the revelation, his living faith. You know, you're not supposed to, you know, put yourself in sublime admiration of his transcendent faith. Oh, it's so magically wonderful. No. It's like, that's a real human faith. I'm supposed to exactly embody that faith. I can have that exact same living faith. And I'm expected to. And that, and if you have that living faith nucleus, a sphere of truth can form around that, and then you can begin to, ingest some of the greater things that can come from part four of the book. But if you just start with credulous belief and try to wrap part four of the book around the ghost cult credulous belief, that's new wine and old wineskins. You're just going to end up with some, you know, fancy Jesusism out of that. You're not going to get the fourth epical revelation. Okay, what about the fifth?
Five, the Urantia Papers. The papers of which this is one constitute the most recent presentation of truth to the mortals of Urantia. These papers differ from all previous revelations, for they are not the work of a single universe personality, but a composite presentation by many beings. But no revelation short of the attainment of the Universal Father can ever be complete. All other celestial ministrations are no more than partial, transient, and practically adapted to local conditions in time and space. While such admissions as this may possibly detract from the immediate force and authority of all revelations, the time has arrived on Urantia when it is advisable to make such frank statements, even at the risk of weakening the future influence and authority of this, the most recent of the revelations of truth to the mortal races of Urantia.
That latter part, you know, reminding you of the evolutional thing we talked about up front. Okay, and, you know, disabuse yourself of this notion of, oh, I've just found absolute truth. And I say, no, it's relative. They're talking to you after all. you might want to, you know, check your your self-admiration if you think, oh, I could receive absolute truth. That's a little bit third principle of the Lucifer Manifesto. My mind is innately divine, right? Okay. So, like they're saying, it's high time that a sophisticated, philosophic human be encouraged and spoken to. Right? They're going to treat you as an adult of God, and you're going to have to try to rise to that challenge, okay? Because that's not how they find you. Remember, they told you they don't find you as an adult of God. They're trusting that this will be focused by your adjuster enough that you'll slowly get spun up, and eventually you'll be moving towards an adult of God. Okay, but if they're speaking to an adult of God, Jesus was speaking to children of God. He tried to speak to like an older child or an adolescent, and they didn't get nowhere, just blew up on him. So it's like, okay, I'm going to boil it down to just basic little children of God. yeah, we all know how that worked. But you know, the fifth epic of Revelation is challenging you to be an adult of God, and they're going to speak frankly to you about things. They're going to say things to you that are going to send you into philosophic chaos. They're going to say things that you could twist and really horrendously abuse to the detriment of your fellow man. They're going to say some serious stuff to you. Then the other thing there just that needs to be emphasized. So, if you want to talk about, the object that's in my lap, it's a particular typesetting. It's got some additional things, maybe like a table of contents and a cover and things. Okay, that's appropriately called the Arantia book and, a particular reference, paper, section, paragraph, right, is relative to the Urantia book. Okay, but if you want to speak about what's not in the book, what can't be defined with words, the truth, they're telling you, well, when you get precise like that, call the truth the Urantia papers. Call the object that you read the book. Right? So it's appropriate to sing this, was given the title of the Arantia book to separate it from a designation for the fifth epical revelation of truth itself, the Arantia papers. It seems like a subtle distinction, but you need some sort of distinction, and they're giving it to you right there. They're suggesting that. Just use that little contrast. Do your paper section reference to the Arantia book. And then, in the same way that you might say the fifth epical revelation, right, all in lowercase, okay, if you want a proper designation for that, where the T is capitalized and the U is capitalized and the P is capitalized, okay, that's the Arantia papers. Just like Jesus of Nazareth, right, or Melchizedek of Salem. Right? Okay, so that's, that's one little, subtle distinction that you could bring in. The more that you challenge yourself to remind yourself of that difference between the words that you read, the words that you reference, and the truth that you're trying to recognize.
Which you really can't get if you don't read the words.
Right, of course not. You can't just sleep on it. You have to read the words, drag the words into the lower domain of your hourglass, and then see if you can transcend them in a synthetic wholeness of truth up in the upper domain. And you'd like that sphere of truth to match up with, whatever author, sphere of truth was there before he degraded it, put it down in his lower domain, and spit it out. It's a bunch of words. So you want to do a lot more than memorize words. You want to transcend the words and find the wholeness of truth that flows through the words. Something that you can live. Something that you can obey. Something that matches up with a living faith. Doesn't just lay there with a dead faith, next to it. All right, we're not going to try to read this whole next section. And we don't want to. We want to just do this initial part.
Can I ask a question about that?
Yeah.
When it says admissions such as this may detract from the force and authority of all revelations, why is that? I don't understand what it's saying.
Just what I was saying up front. You mean this isn't absolute? There's relativity to this? Well, I'm not interested in anything that isn't absolute. I want to capitalize the T on the truth. Yeah, I remember how they tell you that humans always want to call their religious notions the truth, right? It's like, no, this is not inspired, okay? It's not some magical text, okay? You have to, you know, in order to properly interpret it, you've got to notice, did they say trust and faith, or did they say faith and trust? You've got to pick the proper sense of the word of, you know. You don't just read it and you're magically transformed into a being that's better than everyone else. It's not like that. But that's why humans have always wanted a revelation, because it turns them into a magical chosen person that's better than everyone else. They can stick that in their face. You know, I'm a child of the truth, and you're not. No, it's not, you know. And the reason that really significant movements have taken off and spread over the globe is because their followers believe that they have absolute truth, and they're all fired up by that, and they get millions of converts, and they change the whole planet. And if you got a book that says no, it's not like that, you know, and you got to. Sometimes it gets really complicated. You've got to transcend anyone who's ever thought in order to properly interpret this section. Yeah, no, that's not going to start some vast movement that's going to sweep the globe and make trillions of dollars. No.
Okay. Some other section say, the revelation is going to be, the facts of the revelation are going to become obsolete.
Yeah.
And therefore, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater, because his truth is still going to be there.
Like, eventually, we will know that a nucleus of an atom is not made out of protons and neutrons. Eventually, we will figure that out. Okay? But again, if you think this is an absolute disclosure of fact, okay, well, what about when it says protons and neutrons? It's like, no. Think about it from a truth vantage point. It's saying, okay, you think about it in the sense of protons and neutrons right now. Yeah, and if you look at those sections, you'll see I'm not making that up. You notice they're saying, okay, you think about it like this for now. Have you thought about looking at it in a slightly different way? They're giving you how you think about it and suggesting. They're not allowed to, go across the line. So they're talking about where you are in a very suggestive way. They're talking truthfully, right? There's a truth to protons and neutrons in the nucleus, even though it isn't a fact. See, and that sentence is nonsensical to everyone else on the planet right now. If anyone else on the planet listened to what I just said, they would know I was an idiot and would stop listening. I think that's just bull crap. There is no such thing as it's a truth to it, but not a fact to it. They don't understand, this difference. Okay. In fact, there are not protons and neutrons in the nucleus. But there must be a truth to it, or why would we think that after all kinds of exhaustive scientific examination and stuff? There must be some sense in which that's valid.
It must be a nucleus.
Even if it isn't literally a fact. Right? There must be a way, when you actually know what it literally is, you go, oh, it has these symmetries to it. And you could falsely literalize those symmetries as if it was a collection of billiard balls, right? Just like you could literalize the facets of a quartz crystal and say there are literally, the number of billiard balls, equal to the number of facets of the quartz crystal. If you couldn't see the quartz crystal, it was just some thing you couldn't get your hands on, but you tried to, bounce things off of it. It's like, well, sometimes when I throw a ball in there, it bounces like this. Okay, so there must be a little billiard ball right there, and then I threw it this way, and then it bounces that way. Okay, so there must be another billiard ball there. It's like, no, there aren't literally billiard balls there. Those are faces of one crystal. Okay, that's just an analogy. That's what the nucleus isn't literally, a quartz crystal with faces like that. Okay, but it's the same sort of a thing. There's a symmetry to it where you can assume that it's that number of neutrons and that number of proton billiard balls, and you kind of sort of get correct answers in some things. Okay. But it isn't literally that. Any more than the sun goes around the earth literally. But if you assume it, you can get the correct answers to a lot of things. Okay, it's just like that. Okay, eventually we will know, you know, some of these things like that. Okay, and you know, and if we had already figured that out, they wouldn't have talked about protons and neutrons. They would have worded things differently. Right? Yeah. We know that they literally added things in the early 40s, you know, kind of the last little things, because we made some new little discovery. It's like, oh, that's really handy. Let's modify that little part right there and leverage off that a little bit. They just made a handy little discovery there. You know, who knows what that section was like, you know, before we made that little discovery. It was probably some really even more hand-wavy sort of a suggestive thing, you know. They could be, you know, a little bit more concrete because of some of the new discovery we made. Right? You know, it's in that sense, okay? But it's not like eventually you'll know that this book is erroneous. No, there's not, absolutely not one iota of error in the book. It's a revelation of truth. It's an authoritative elimination of error, okay? If you interpret that sentence that, oh, there's errors in the book, well, that's in contradiction to the statement that says it's an authoritative elimination of error. It can't be erroneous and an authoritative elimination of error, okay? What's the problem? You've made a false assumption. It's not telling you that there's errors in the book. It's telling you that they've given it to you as an evolutional construct. It's adapted to, you know, the way you're talking about things right now. If we'd been talking about things differently, they would have talked about things differently. Because the point is not to disclose facts, the point is to reveal truth. And if facts get disclosed along the way, well, that's cool too. That's not the point.
But some of the facts, you know, like hormone and stuff like that, that we would never discover.
Of course, right.
Got to be true.
Right, right. Yeah. You know, they want to reveal sweeping truth, so they have to disclose all kinds of facts, and it's no problem disclosing those facts because, you know, we can't figure them out ourselves. So those facts are always disclosed to every world. No one can figure that stuff out by themselves. Every world gets those things disclosed. Right? Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. So, see, that sort of sophisticated thing, which causes lots of readers to stumble and lots of people on the planet to just to dismiss it outright. Yeah, that's what they're talking about here, right? It's going to detract from the immediate force and authority when you talk about it like that. Okay? But if you had just some collection of gibberish with a bunch of zealous people that just authoritatively declared it, there would be tens of millions of people, you know, and an active movement. We've proven that over and over again. You take the tiniest little bunch of drivel, and if you just talk about it definitively, you get millions of followers. Hundreds of millions of dollars pour into the coffers. Right? You can start a movement based upon just anything. But if you actually reveal rigorous truth, you know, or challenge people to figure out what the difference is between truth and fact, okay, you're going to have five people on the planet that are even interested, right? And those people are going to be confused, trying to figure out, I don't know what the heck they're talking about here. I'm interested, but man, I'm confused. And that's what we're dealing with here. All right, let's get a little bit of this next section in.
Five, the great religious leaders. In evolutionary religion, the gods are conceived to exist in the likeness of man's image. In revelatory religion, men are taught that they are God's sons, even fashioned in the finite image of divinity. In the synthesized beliefs compounded from the teachings of revelation and the products of evolution, the God concept is a blend of 1. The pre-existent ideas of the evolutionary cults, 2. The sublime ideals of revealed religion, 3. The personal viewpoints of the great religious leaders, the prophets, and teachers of mankind.
Okay, a couple things there. So what we're, you know, first of all, so we went through the five epical revelations, and now they want to kind of put what we just introduced there together with the whole evolutionary religious context and say, well, okay, so those epical revelations melted into the evolutionary religion. Yeah, what rolled out? So they want to go through that that process. They start out with that whole the anthropomorphic God issue. And you say, oh, it's so much better in revelatory religion. It's not anthropomorphic like that. Men are taught that they are God's sons, even fashioned in the finite image of divinity. Oh, what could go wrong with that little declaration? Oh, I'm innately divine. I don't know if this is an improvement. Maybe we should go back to the anthropomorphic thing. Right? This sounds like real harm could befall me if I run with this. See, we've already talked about that. That's the difficulty with revelation. And it needs managing, active, ongoing managing. That's why there's an ongoing prince and his staff, ongoing Adam and Eve, right? They say a few things and they try to keep it between the lines, right? You just toss something out there. Oh, boy. And of course, that's what Caligastrian, they tossed a couple things out there and just blew up civilization, right? They were thinking it was going to have these positive consequences. No, it's just horrendously negative, right? A little information is just completely disruptive. But nonetheless, there's that. But then, like they're saying, you're going to have the synthesized revelation and evolutionary religion. But notice it isn't just two elements there. As soon as you start talking about this coming together, there's a third element at item number three there, the personal viewpoints of the great religious leaders, the prophets and teachers of mankind. And even if they're prophets and not merely teachers, they're literally someone that celestials are actively engaging and tweaking in some way. Even then, all that tweaking is going into their worldview, right? Just like, if your adjuster tweaks you, right, that goes into your worldview frame and becomes a grotesque distortion. These personal viewpoint things, right? The Apostle Paul hears Jesus say a few things and he incorporates that into his framework and out comes all sorts of groovy things. And of course, even with the 12, Jesus is looking right in Peter's eyes and telling him point blank certain things, and it's this blah, blah. All Peter hears is blah 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 blah. Yeah, affirmation. It's exactly what I've always believed. And Jesus is saying the exact opposite of, but Peter can't hear it, right? Because it's immediately getting all twisted in his pre-existent frame of reference. He's absorbing those words into the ghost cult, and literally they're flipped 180 degrees, and he's talking right to his face, okay? Right. So right, that third element means that it's going, there's a moray frame, for instance, in that individual. That revelatory religion gets heard by an individual, and put into that moray frame. See, that is, no other reason is why they were saying before how it goes from revelatory religion to the mores and then to evolutionary religion, right? Because you have to ingest it, and the more frame is in there, especially if you've literally lifted that more frame up as the quote-unquote moral, the social usage context that you've in that upper domain, right? So, that's a very key thing that these individuals and their pre-existent, their preconceived opinions, settled ideas, and longstanding prejudices color whatever is said, even if it's literally, effectively a master, son, universe, local universe of Nebadon talking literally to you, your face. All right, so that is going to be that, you know, as we all know, the story of the evolutionary religions involves all kinds of fancy people, right, that have gotten exalted into near godlike status. Okay.
Most great religious epics have been inaugurated by the life and teachings of some outstanding personality. Leadership has originated a majority of the worthwhile moral movements of history, and men have always tended to venerate the leader, even at the expense of his teachings, to revere his personality, even though losing sight of the truths which he proclaimed. And this is not without reason. There is an instinctive longing in the heart of evolutionary man for help from above and beyond. This craving is designed to anticipate the appearance on Earth of the planetary prince and the later material suns. On Urantia, man has been deprived of these superhuman leaders and rulers, and therefore does he constantly seek to make good this loss by enshrouding his human leaders with legends pertaining to supernatural origins and miraculous careers.
Gosh, don't tell that to too many people. You got enough of those people already.
All right, so, yeah, I was talking about... All right, so, even in the best of times, Jesus spawns Jesusism. You know, Muhammad spawns Muhammadanism. You know, yeah, Buddha, got, you know, Gautama Siddhartha, you know, Gautama Siddhartha spawns Buddhism. You know, et cetera. Confucianism, you know, Taoism, you know, whatever, you name it. Right, all these... leader-isms, right, like you're saying. And it's not because we're just that freaking hopeless. I mean, we're literally programmed that way by the life carriers. I mean, we can't help ourselves because they've got to make it so that we'll, you know, accept and look up to the prince and his staff and Adam and Eve. So we're just hardwired that way. So, you know, it's just like the, you know, the little creature that loses its biologic mother. You know, the first animal that comes along is mommy, right? You know, we do the same thing. It's like, you know, we just, there it is, there's Adam. You know, we don't know that's what we're, you know, what our programming is about, but you know, we make someone Adam, and we all prostrate ourselves like they prostrated themselves around the literal Adam, you know, 35,000 years ago, and. Yeah, so 40,000 years ago, whichever you want to say.
It even happens at local levels.
Yep. The
churches and things.
Right.
All kinds of religious movements or leaders.
Or just non-religious things.
Right.
You want to make a political figure, right, the high priest. Right. You want to make him Adam. Right. This is the problem with politics. Everyone is trying to vote for Adam. It's like, no, you're trying to vote for the chief executive, for Pete's sake. You know, you're voting for president. You're not voting for Adam. Right? But people just can't help themselves. They want to vote for Adam. They want their Adam. You know,
just said, we're still trying to make good on
voting. Yeah, right. So you've heard me.
That's universal. It's not just.
Yeah, right. It's everywhere, every planet, every mortal's programmed this way. Yeah, but boy, is it problematic if you literally don't have Adam and Eve. You know, then everyone effectively, you know, becomes a that individual either temporarily or mystically permanently, right? Or you exalt that person into some, you know, transcendent being, right? That becomes more and more the object of worship rather than God. You know?
Which is exactly what Jesus was afraid of.
Right,
Right,
you've heard me talk about that a million times. It's like, don't you got to catch yourself? You're going to want, when you read part four, you're going to want to make that the Adam substitute. You're going to want to worship the person that's talked about in there. Right, that's what you're programmed to do. You're programmed for Jesusism. It's not something that you are doing, you know. Unfortunately, no, you can't do anything else naturally, but to read part four and turn it into Jesusism. You have to unnaturally not do that. Right?
Look at how Adam and Eve actually responded when they did that in the garden.
Yeah.
Right away.
Yeah.
It wasn't fast enough. They had to.
Right.
They got.
They wanted to snuff that out instantaneously. Yes.
Right.
And you should do the same with yourself. instant you catch yourself trying to turn someone into Adam, whether it's in a political or an economic or a social or you know, you ranch a book or a religious content, whatever, stop, right? Catch yourself doing that, right?
Yeah, that's the point.
And of course, the real Father is not the Adam you're looking for either, because Adam helps you in time. The universal Father has no relationship to time. See, so he's not going to satisfy that Adam need either. The more you read parts or papers 1 through 5 properly, instead of in the ghost cult, the more you read them properly, the more they're going to be disappointing, because it's like, I was looking for Adam. This is telling me he's not. See, you're going to feel an emptiness still. Papers 1 through 5 is not going to satisfy your Adam desire. So you're still going to be looking for an Adam. It's inescapable. The only way we can get out of this is for Machiavelli and Melchizedek, for instance, to assume material son status, okay, and be there, let's say, finally we have our Adam. Okay? And it'll be an appropriate Adam. Okay.
And we'll probably get another son.
Yeah. Not to mention, that's what they're talking about. You know, he could be both of these that were programmed, both the planetary prince and the Adam, right? He could. So we'd completely have those holes filled inside of us, and we would stop trying to make political leaders and stuff our Adam, our planetary prince. Okay. A little bit more here.
Many races have conceived of their leaders as being born of virgins. Their careers are liberally sprinkled with miraculous episodes, and their return is always expected by their respective groups. In Central Asia, the tribesmen still look for the return of Genghis Khan. In Tibet, China, and India, it is Buddha. In Islam, it is Muhammad. Among Amerinds, it was Hisunanin Anamanalantan. With the Hebrews, it was, in general, Adam's return as a material ruler. In Babylon, the god Marduk was a perpetuation of the Adam legend, the son of God idea, the connecting link between man and God. Following the appearance of Adam on earth, so-called sons of God were common among the world races.
Okay, let's deal with that last part first. See, that's what we were just vamping on, right? Everyone's got this Adam hole they're trying to fill inside of them, you know? And so, the Hebrews, you know, they're just pointing out, see, in general, right, it is really an Adam thing that's playing in them. And then you have all of these Adam copies, you know, that are just bringing the fact of Adam into your mythological scheme, right? With the Babylonians, it was Marduk, right? And like they're pointing out, everyone had effectively Adam. Someone...
was way before Adam.
Well, hold on, we haven't gotten there yet. but just dealing with this Adam, you know, substitute thing. Like they're pointing out, the whole Son of God thing, you know, whether you see it in the Hindus or wherever you find that. See, what they're pointing out, the fact that there literally was an Adam, and people literally knew that for a long time, right, that got into all of the various schemes. He's not going to be called Adam. He's going to be called something else. But he is effectively Adam. He's a son of God. He came down from heaven or whatever. He's incarnated or you know something. I mean, those sorts of schemes. Okay, now, back to the beginning of the paragraph. You know, when you read the beginning, many races have conceived of their leaders as being born of virgins. Their careers are liberally sprinkled with miraculous episodes, and their return is always expected by their respective groups. Gee, I wonder if that's Christianity fits into that. Right, because, again, it's Christianity isn't about the real Jesus. It's about this mythical type, you know, individual called Jesus, and it's Jesusism, right? And ism has, the object of the ism is born of a virgin. He's got all kinds of miracles, right? You know, and you don't think of Jesus's so-called miracles In scientific terms, everyone thinks of him in magical terms, right? It's the magical thing, and his return is, expected, of course. See, that's just the old wineskin stuff. And scholarly people recognize this. That's why they dismiss Christianity, right? And a lot of times don't even believe that Jesus ever literally lived. It's like, no, that's just the same old story as everyone tells. Right? They make up some person and they make him born of a virgin and blah, 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 blah. Right? And whether it's Genghis Khan or Buddha or Muhammad. Okay, and then with the Amerinds, the Amerinds, have an individual that they think of like that they call Hesunanan. Hesunanan means our father. They call him our father, like our father who art in heaven. Okay, they literally call him our father. See, so obviously when a Christian comes along and says, our father who art in heaven, they go, oh, I know that. That's Hesunanan. That literally means our father. Okay, and sparks up the great spirit stuff again, right? Okay, Hesunanan is, that's what they have. That's what the Amerinds have. That means our father. And the revelators are just saying, that our father they're talking about, that's the person that we've named Anamanalantan in here. Okay. Or if you want now, just kind of like, saying Christ Michael, where you play the two together. You play the Christian and the Revelation together. Yeah. Hesunanan Anamanalantan, our father Anamanalantan. Yeah, you play the two together. Because he is their father, and their legend myths. Right, vaguely remember that they were there in the redwoods along the the Pacific Ocean and all that. Right? Our father, Anamanalantan. Okay, and then just one last little paragraph here.
But regardless of the superstitious awe in which they were often held, it remains a fact that these teachers were the temporal personality fulcrums on which the levers of revealed truth depended for the advancement of the morality, philosophy, and religion of mankind.
Okay, so even though we've got all these issues of stuff getting assimilated into their worldview scheme and twisted around and reworked and whatnot, okay, we're seeing what we saw so many times. But this is the way the evolutionary process has to work, right? Despite all the issues, like with the priesthood, despite all the issues here with these great leaders, right, they are the temporal personality fulcrums, right, that you can leverage off of to try to springboard yourself from time to eternity. Okay, we need leaders with all of their warts. Because because the run-of-the-mill individual, right, is not one of that, there's never been more than 1%, right? I mean, most of us are common man, right? And we need a leader individual that we can leverage off of. And notice how sweeping it is, right? We depend on them for the advancement of morality, philosophy, and religion. So it's you can see again they're trying to point out we bring in all this epical revelation and whatnot or even auto revelation, but it all has to be assimilated into the evolutionary system, and it works just like everything else that we saw, where so much of all of the early history of mankind we progress in spite of ourselves. We progress in spite of the deficits of leaders. Because again, it's not humanism, right? It's ruled by supremacy and can take whatever finite facts forward. That's the truth of the facts of time, right? That they are always in the whole, ever progressing. They can't do anything else. They're subservient to the whole. Okay, so then next time we'll get into the details where we see how periods of human history play out relative and subsequent to those epical revelations, and how that feeds into the evolutionary religions and spawns various religious leaders, and so we'll kind of flesh out the details of that whole process some more next time. All right, let's take a moment, everyone.